Some of the stories may not be suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to the Worth Repeating podcast. I'm Tori Poole. This is the first part of the live storytelling event recorded at the Irma and Emilio Nicolás Media Center at Texas Public Radio in downtown San Antonio. The theme was reset, stories about reimagining the impossible and starting again. Can you think of a time you needed a do-over? The first storyteller is Quentin Taylor Garcia. Quentin shares a story about a time he had to learn to see things differently.
Well, as you guys heard, my name is Quentin Taylor Garcia, and I'm going to let you guys in on my little crazy brain cells of being a veteran. So the first thing that happened is maybe 100 pounds ago. You know, when I was really fit, you know, I was in the Marine Corps, switched to the Army, started going all over the world, 5 different countries, playing soccer. I was, you know, lean, mean fighting machine, real good stuff. And then all of a sudden, 2012, I come home on vacation, as we call leave, and I'm working on the computer, and then my eyes started closing, just one eye. It moves down real low. And I'm like, okay, it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I know I'm not tired. So get off the computer, take a little break. Walk around the yard, play with the dog, see what the neighbors are doing, being nosy, just looking out the window. You know, we all do that. Don't judge me. So go back to the computer again, started working. Same thing happens again. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to go to the emergency room, see what's going on. On my way to the emergency room, now both eyes are starting to shut down a little bit while I'm driving. Yes, Jesus help me. So going to the emergency room, I go in there. I said, Doc, I don't know what's going on with my eyes. It's not listening to me. Of course, you sit there for like 9 hours. You know, it's typical. Finally get there. They look at me and they're like, oh, you know, it could be this. They write down a piece of paper and send me home. I'm like, but you didn't look at me. You didn't give me anything. And this is February 28th. How I remember, this is like, my reset is like 9/11. You're a lean, mean fighting machine. You in 5 to 7 different countries. You training with all these other Marines, all these other sailors in different branches, different countries. And then all of a sudden, a little thing changed your life. Just like that. Go back home, take a nice little rest, woke up in the morning, started working again. The eyes started shutting down. I'm like, okay, they need to figure out something. So I go back to the emergency room. I said, I'm not leaving here until you guys figure it out. Now it's leap year, February 29th. I'm there all day, and they decided to send me up to the optometry to get my eye looked at because they're supposed to be the pros. If you're in the optometry field, I'm sorry. So I'm sitting in the optometry field. I'm sitting back there, and he's like, oh, I don't know what it is, but can I call a friend? Now, if you're in the emergency room and they got a dollar friend, So of course, I'm like, whatever, doc, just do your thing, do your thing. So he calls a buddy from college, and he's like, hey, I got a patient here. This is what's going on. I think I know what it is, but I'm not sure. So he's like, okay, you remember in the last semester, in the last class, there was like a last little chapter? I think that's what it is. I'm sitting in the chair scared for life now. And I'm like, ugh, I hope he was in the top of his class because I might die today. Okay, let me go back. I'm being serious. Woosah. Okay, so I'm sitting there, and he says, I'm going to get a bag of ice, and I'm going to turn off the lights, and I'm going to put this on your eye. I said, ooh, that sounds like a thriller movie. I don't know. So he puts it on there. I'm sitting there for 15 minutes. After 15 minutes, he comes back in the room, turns on the light, and my eye is open back up to normal. He said, I got it. I know what you have. I'm like, good. What is it? He said, you have myasthenia gravis. I'm like, what is that? How do you spell it? So it's so bad and it's so rare. He gave me his medical book to take home with me to read up on it. So this is 2012. I'm on vacation and I have to go back to my unit in Ohio, and I'm here in Texas in Killeen. So I'm telling my unit, hey, I got a medical condition. They think they know what it is, but I can't drive that long distance. Military. La-di-da-di, everybody. We need to be here. So get your butt here. So I'm driving to Ohio, lean back in my seat because I can't see. So I'm like this trying to drive. Very unsafe. Do not try this at home. So I'm going back. I get to my unit and they set up all my doctor's appointments. So as I go through my doctor's appointments, there's one appointment that said 4 days to do it. I'm like, doc, what kind of stuff you got to do that takes 4 days? He said, we need to find out about your nerves. I was like, I got bad nerves. I'm in the military. Come on. So he comes in the room and there's needles everywhere. There's a machine that he has to check all your nerves all around you. So they start from the top of my head and work half of my body. It's almost a half a day of them doing this. Then they have to do the other side. Now, to test your nerves, they have to check in your ears, in your eyes, under your fingernails, everywhere. So now I'm at the point of, do I really need to live? This is crazy, insane. So here comes the frustration. They come in, we need to do blood work. 9 tubes. I'm like, okay, vampires, go for it. They take my blood. I'm sitting there waiting. They're like, you know what? It might be a false positive, so come back tomorrow, we need to do it again. And don't forget to fast. It's like, all right, fine. I get back to work, and they said, hey, we don't care about that right now. We need to do our mission. You can do that on your off time. So they used to me being grade A at the top of my game. Now I have something that's going on with me right now that you guys cannot see. So I look normal to you all. So now I'm battling my marriage because my family and friends is like, hey, we know who you are. You've been playing soccer since you was a little kid. You're awesome. You're good. So that's not the problem. We all know the problem now. But to be honest, if you know anybody has a rare disease and they look normal, trust me, we are not normal. We have to deal with mental anguish. This is not even PTSD. You are dealing with people that don't believe you. Family, friends, neighbors, work. Nobody think you're like sick or anything. I get to California and my body crashes. I'm walking home with the rest of the soldiers. I step up on the sidewalk and I flop like a bag of potatoes. I cannot move. I cannot pick up my arms. I could only speak. That is where my life totally reset. I'm used to banking on my body. I'm running 3 to 6 miles. I got a 90-pound pack. I got my weapon. I have to make sure the people on the side of me is safe. I have soldiers I'm in charge of. And now they're seeing their boss that was in front of the line is now in the back. Hard to breathe, hard to see, hard to focus. And everybody thinks you're a liar. It is very difficult, very difficult. And for me doing this here and TPR doing this, I really appreciate it because I want y'all to know when your family and friends say, hey, there's something wrong with me, there is something wrong. Thank you.
Quentin shows us that there are things that are ailing us that sometimes we cannot see. Know someone with a great story? Tell them about Worth Repeating. Worth Repeating is now accepting submissions for the final live event of the season on the theme Bash. From tough blows to blowout parties, these stories are all about wild nights out. Submit your story today by visiting tpr.org/WR.
This program was made possible with support from the 80/20 Foundation, striving to transform San Antonio by issuing grants to public charities that attract, grow, and retain San Antonio's future workforce. For this and more information, visit 8020foundation.com.
Our next storyteller is Michael Martinez. Michael shares a story about a trip that altered the direction of his life.
St. Anthony, or San Antonio, is a saint of lost and found things. My life has almost been lost in the city twice. The first time was when I was born, because I was born very sick. In fact, the doctors told my parents to take pictures of my little baby body because my chances of survival were so low. The one chance I had was the advanced military-grade medical equipment they had at Brooke Army Medical Center here in San Antonio. So they put my baby body into a helicopter, rushed me through the sky to BAMC, as they call it, and that equipment indeed saved my life. And to this day, my mother calls me her miracle baby. We left Texas and raised me. Family raised me in my mother's hometown, Ithaca, New York. It's far ways away. Thank you. interesting place to grow up, really beautiful place, but this was the inception of a lifelong identity crisis, because here I was, this guy born in Texas with a Spanish last name and around my mom's family, and I didn't really know who my dad's family was, because for reasons having to do with the prison system and the criminal element of West Texas, I didn't really know my dad's side of the family. I only knew that we were named Martinez, we were sort of from this state, but beyond that, I knew nothing. They were musicians and they were delinquents, and that's pretty much it. Which wouldn't be such a big deal, except anytime someone saw my name written, they would say, because this is Ithaca, New York, they would say, oh, Martinez, cool, mucho gusto, where are you from? What part of Mexico is your family from? And that's great. Are you English speaking at home, Spanish speaking, citizenship status, all this kind of stuff? And it didn't really bother me, except that I had no idea what the deal was with my family. I only knew that we were musicians and from Texas and this kind of thing. Another thing that happened to me in Ithaca was the musical genes in my body got unlocked, because I would go to a festival called Grassroots Festival of Music and Dance, which is a great place to see live music. Every year, the third weekend in July, it's really a who's who of musical traditions, roots music, they call it, folk music, everything from Appalachian fiddle bands to Congolese rock bands. They have honky-tonk royalty from Nashville come up. I mean, it's stuff that you're never going to see anywhere else. They also have, a key feature is they'll bring up bands from Southwest Louisiana, and I have fond memories of dancing all night long, because those bands really can play till the early morning to that Zydeco music. It's like the premier Creole accordion music from Southwest Louisiana. It's so fun. And at this festival, I really said, I want to be one of those guys on the stage, because I had such a good time. It was a magical experience. And I did. I began to play music, and I sort of constructed an identity from afar. Not knowing who I was, I used music to solve this identity crisis. I would play songs in English and Spanish. I would sort of grasp at straws in a way. I was listening to bands like Intocable and Tigres del Norte and Selena and stuff like that. And I would cover those songs on the street and in bars where I would play music. And I was gaining good traction, and it was going really well up there. But the specters of appropriation and tokenism were haunting me. And it just didn't feel right. I couldn't do it up there so far away. I wanted to be where it lives and dies. So I came all the way back down to San Antonio. And it was going really well. One night, a buddy of mine was visiting town. And I had a show out in Terlingua, Texas. And I said, hey, man, let's head out to Terlingua, and we'll sleep in our trucks the day of, and we'll play the show that night. You can really have a great Texan adventure. So we headed out, Route 90 West. If you've ever made that trip during the day, you can attest to the fact that that's an arduous, long trip. It's very remote. We made the trip at night, ill-advised. I flipped that truck over, hit a mesquite tree, truck was totaled, you know, blood everywhere, broken bones, that kind of thing. My buddy, running on adrenaline and instinct, pulls me from the truck. There's no cell phone service out there. We're in deep rural West Texas. Flags a trucker down, gets an ambulance to the scene. They take me to a hospital in Del Rio. The hospital say, this man's gonna die. He doesn't stand much of a chance. There's only one chance, and that's the Advanced Trauma Center at Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio, Texas. So they put me in a helicopter, fly me through the west, south Texas sky, land me in the Bamsey, and actually woke up in that same hospital from when I was born. I woke up bald because they thought I might need brain surgery. Thankfully, I didn't. But I woke up, the truck totaled. I had pretty much everything I owned in that truck. And I just woke up there and I said, you know, maybe playing music professionally isn't such a good idea. I don't know if I want to do this anymore. It's dangerous and there's not really that much money in it. I'm kind of done with this. But I wanted to solve my identity crisis. So, like I said, my father didn't really want me to associate with his brothers and my cousins and everything. But there was one uncle that wasn't so bad. I gave him a call and I said, hey, you're a lot older than my dad. You knew my grandfather, who I never met. Who are we? What's our deal? Why is our name Martinez? I don't understand it. We're not Mexican. I don't get it. Like, who are we? And he said, well, your grandfather died in Big Spring, Texas, and your cousins all grew up there and everything. But he was really from outside of New Orleans, Louisiana, and he spent much of his life in Biloxi, Mississippi. He was as Creole as it get, actually. And it seemed like everything just came full circle, because when I heard this from the horse's mouth, all that fiddle music and accordion music that I used to dance to at Grassroots came back to me. And I came all the way down to San Antonio to be part of a musical scene that I felt I could belong to. In a way, maybe I do, but I got brought back home in a sense that, yes, I can make my home here in San Antonio or back in my hometown in Ithaca, but I really felt like I was destined to play music again, like I did before the accident. And while I was recovering from all those injuries, I was getting pretty heavily into some texts, anthropological texts and folklore and stuff. Joseph Campbell, who wrote The Hero's Journey. And that's somewhat of a famous book. I felt like I was kind of on a hero's journey. And he said, famously, it's become a cliche, I guess. He said, follow your bliss. And even though my bliss got me smashed into a mesquite tree, nearly killed, and cost me a shiny red Tacoma, I will continue to follow mine.
We're glad Michael survived both trips. Worth Repeating returns March 12th, and the theme is savor. From comforting cuisine to competitive kitchens, these stories are all about those moments you want to last. Make plans to be there by grabbing tickets today by visiting tpr.org/WR.
This program was made possible by the City of San Antonio Department of Arts and Culture, striving to enrich the quality of life of San Antonio residents and visitors by creating art programming and helping people experience art. For this and more information, visit getcreativesanantonio.com.
Our next storyteller is Yvania Frausto. Yvania shares a story about how triggering social media can be and her new normal.
I was 19 in my first apartment, and I was scrolling through social media, I think Instagram, and a video popped up on my screen. It was trying to emulate how schizophrenics feel when having an episode. And I remember the black and white tiles on the floor were moving and waving, and patterns and colors were coming in and out, and I had this really uneasy feeling. So I put my phone down, and I looked at my backsplash of my kitchen, and I saw black and white tiles, and they started to move. And the caulking in between the tiles started to wave at me and taunt me. And then I looked at my plant, and it turned from green to like a blue hue, and I felt sick, like I couldn't stand. So I got down on my hands and knees, and I tried to crawl to my couch, but I couldn't quite prop myself up on it, so I just laid there next to the coffee table. And I tried to unlock my phone, but the Face ID wasn't working, because even though I hadn't noticed it, I had been crying so hard that my eyes had swollen shut. And so I held the side button down, and I said, "Call Mama." I was 18 when I got diagnosed with being bipolar type 2. It was a happy diagnosis because I finally knew what it was. I wasn't making it up, and there was a reason why I was feeling like this. My family felt more or less the same way because there was medicine, there was a plan, and there was hope. But they were also scared, just like I was, because not everyone knew exactly what bipolar meant, or at least for me. A lot of people see it as infidelity and burning down buildings and violence and anger, and sure, some of it is that for some people, but that's not how it manifested itself in me. For me, I had ups and I had downs. My ups consisted of, sure, buying myself Tiffany jewelry when I had a paycheck, but also staying up for 2 to 3 days and feeling like I'm on the top of the world and no one can hurt you, but you can be hurt. This energy vibrated through me, and I felt like I could feel everything and nothing at all. And then on my downs, I felt nothing and everything in the exact opposite way. I stayed in bed for 2 to 3 days. I got fired from jobs because I kept calling in because I felt like I couldn't get out of bed. Like I was physically planted there and my body had dropped dead, but my mind was left to wander around the room and it wasn't thinking happy thoughts. So now I'm laying on the floor in my apartment and I'm telling my phone something is wrong. My mom took about 30 minutes to get to my apartment. It was a while because I wanted to move far away from my family for my first apartment and be independent. But now I needed her, just like she said I would. And she told me I needed to go to the hospital. So she took me and I got wheeled in on a wheelchair. And I expected to be taken to the back and be told I was having a seizure or a heart attack or something and be pumped full of tranquilizers and I'd wake up in 2 days with some red gel on my bedside table and feeling better than ever. But that's not what happened. Instead, the nurse slowly typed my symptoms out on her computer and she never looked me in the eyes. For the 8 hours I was there, no one looked me in the eyes. In that waiting room, mothers and daughters screamed and cried in pain. And they didn't take any of us seriously. They didn't take care of us until a bed opened. We weren't people or patients until a bed opened. And I can see why they might not want to take care of me right away. I mean, they couldn't see what was wrong with me. They couldn't feel it. They couldn't patch it up with gauze and tape. And nobody really cares until we hurt somebody or we hurt ourselves. "Are you a harm to yourself or others?" they would ask me. I always didn't know. At about hour seven, I started to change my viewpoint on everything, starting to realize that this was going to happen for the rest of my life, whether I liked it or not. And I better get used to it, because the minute that bipolar came out of that doctor's mouth, I knew my life was written for me on a dirty napkin, that it was going to be episode and then a journey to normalcy. Normalcy for a bit, a trigger, and then another episode and back again. They told me to try Laurel Ridge. Laurel Ridge is a mental hospital here in town, and my mom took me home, got me a change of clothes, and took me over. I walked in, and they asked me what I was there for, and yet again, I didn't know. I remember these beige windowless doors opening. They had to buzz me in and they took my belongings and put me in a room with about 15 other people. And they all looked lost and they all wanted help. And we all didn't know why we were there. One by one, they would take us back to rooms and see if we made the crazy enough cut. And doctors and nurses would walk through the room, always looking at their feet because they didn't want to look us in the eye. When it was my turn, I got called to a little room. And I signed some papers, then a social worker came in. He looked me in my eyes, and he asked how I was. I wasn't sure. I was confused. The panic had kind of worn off, but I was still seeing things and experiencing this impending doom that I knew was going to come back. I knew it was always going to come back. And he said I wasn't suicidal enough. That Laurel Ridge was too full right now. So I got taken home. And the moment I walked through my front doors, the visions came back. And the feeling that no one cared came back. And my mom tucked me into bed with my teddy bear named Carrots. And I looked at the wall. And I just kept thinking, one, I have a shift in 5 hours. And two, time to reset. Time to start the journey back to normalcy. Thank you.
It certainly helps to have moms close. We wish Yovanya all the best as she navigates this new normal. Worth Repeating is now a book. Trinity University Press and TPR are proud to present Worth Repeating San Antonio Stories, featuring 40 true narratives. Pick one up at the next live event on March 12th or at your nearest book retailer. Your support funds programs like these.
This program was made possible by Niche at Pearl. More than clothing, Niche at Pearl features jewelry, accessories, and crafting events. For this and more information, visit nicheatpearl.com.
Our next storyteller is Elaine Lang. Elaine shares a story about how it took a game of bowling to begin again.
My husband and I went bowling one evening. We're not part of a bowling league. We had been married about 7 years. We had had all the normal activities that couples do. I will tell you that I was 44 when I married my husband. He was 47. A second marriage for him, first for me. And we did all the typical conversations that one has in a marriage. Work, of course. Hobbies, of course. Things to do to relax and have fun. Watch TV, go to movies, go out to dinner. And of course, conversations about family. My husband brought to the marriage a grown son and a grown daughter. And they lived back in St. Louis. And we, of course, are in Texas. And you might hope that at 44, I had a lot of maturity and wisdom about life. I wished I did. But I came to the marriage with so many expectations about communication. And after a few years of the marriage, the stress fractures were there. And you know what stress fractures are like. You can't really, the bone isn't broken, but the cracks are there, just waiting for one good thing to snap it open. And so I tried my best. I was like, I will read books. I will talk to friends and family. I will talk about how what communication is to me in a marriage. He sits on the sofa. He asks me questions, deep and penetrating. How do you feel about that? Tell me more. I want to know every detail of all your feelings. Whereas my husband is an introvert, and he is so happy in the garden, alone, with rocks and mulch and fish emulsion, things that make no sense to me. And over time, I draw the line. I say, all right, you're coming to therapy with me. We're going to talk about communication. And my husband is a good sport, and for several months we went. And eventually he said to me, I can't do this anymore. I cannot keep having these conversations with a therapist. And you know, I thought to myself, well, it's not like I was having a great time either, but, you know, you do what you have to do. And at that very same time that he was letting go of the whole how we're going to deal with communication, his daughter called us. She is 29 and recently been married. It was right before Christmas, and she said to us on the phone, I have stage 4 breast cancer. And so we went to St. Louis and spent time with her, and of course, that, as many of you know, that's a whole journey. Double mastectomy, chemotherapy, radiation. And one would hope that we would have come more together in that crisis, and we did for a little while. And then my husband needed to spend a lot of time with his daughter, of course, and she needed her dad. And so he spent a lot of time in St. Louis, and I stayed back in San Antonio, and we struggled. We struggled. I wanted to be a supportive spouse, but I felt like I was the only person not in the family. And so eventually, after lots of thinking and planning and reading and getting wise people to talk to me, someone said to me, why don't you just back off a little bit? Just stop expecting so much of your husband right now and see if you can find some things to do that will just allow you to relax together. And so we took out a piece of paper and we ripped up the piece of paper. We wrote the months of the 12 months on these pieces of paper separately, threw it in a mixing bowl. And the idea was you pull out a slip of paper, no negotiation, no discussion. The other party says, this is what we're going to do for date of the month. And the other party goes along. And my husband picked, I believe he picked April and May, and he was already excited, which I hadn't seen him excited in a long time, so that was really thrilling for me. And he had some ideas about vacation. I think I got January. And I thought to myself, what do you do in Texas in January? We had never been bowling, but I had been bowling as a kid, and I just said to him, let's go bowling. And he said, okay. And so we show up at the bowling alley, and I don't know if you've been there recently. They've changed a lot since the 60s. A lot. No more pieces of paper and thick pencils to keep score. No more having to remember how to do strikes and spears. It's electronic. Like, who knew? And flat screen TVs and music and, you know, arcade games. And there was liquor, which I never remember that as a kid. And we got there and we were having fun. And we bowled the first string and it was just, you know, we were just having fun in the moment. I will say the only thing that seems to have stayed the same in bowling were the bowling shoes. They looked exactly the same as I remembered when I was a kid. And we did the second string, and that was really fun too. And my husband is the athlete of the family. I am the bookworm. And on the third string, I beat him at bowling. And that moment has stayed with us in our marriage. We've had many dates over the years, many, many. That bowling helped us navigate, of course, all of the challenges that his daughter faced and her many treatments, clinical trials, and eventually, of course, her death many years ago. And so, but what I remember most about that bowling night is my husband saying to me as we were leaving, you never told me you were a bowler. And I said to him, I'm just lucky. Thank you.
Sounds like a little healthy competition goes a long way when it comes to relationships. That's it for the Worth Repeating podcast. Do us a favor and like, subscribe, or review us wherever you stream podcasts. Stay tuned for part 2 of the live event on the theme Reset. Support for Worth Repeating comes from the 8020 Foundation, the City of San Antonio Department of Arts and Culture, and Niche at Pearl. Worth Repeating is a production of Texas Public Radio. I'm Tori Poole. Thanks for listening.